Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise! Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable.
Welcome to another edition of ADC Presents CAF Chats. I'm Major James Barrett, and today I've got two juggernauts in the military justice system with me. I've got Major Alex Ultimus, and for those of you out in the field who got a little bit excited, no, Colonel Dave Seagraves is not back. I have Major Dustin Morgan here with me. Good morning to both of you.
Hey, good morning, James.
So today I'd like to discuss United States versus Mendoza with you. That case was argued on March 5th, 2024, and was decided October 7th, 2024. Alex, why don't you go ahead and walk us through the facts?
Sure. So the procedural history and the facts in this case are Staff Sergeant Mendoza was charged with one specification of sex assault in violation of Article 120, B2A, a sexual act upon a person capable of consenting who did not consent. The government elected in this case not to charge Staff Sergeant Mendoza with sexual assault under Article 120, B3 alpha, a sexual act upon a person incapable of consenting. At trial, the government presented a significant amount of evidence of the victim's extreme intoxication and argued she was unable to consent based on the absence of consent. In July of 2020, both Staff Sergeant Mendoza and the victim, JW, were stationed in Korea. On the night in question, the victim went off post and ate and drank with friends, came back, and had joined a barracks party outside, which included Staff Sergeant Mendoza. She testified that she remembered drinking, coming back to the barracks, seeing other soldiers, and continuing to drink with them until she ultimately blacked out. The next thing she remembered was waking up the following morning to Staff Sergeant Mendoza knocking on her barracks door to return her shoes. She did not recognize him, did not answer the door. He then came back a second time. During this time, she woke up, she went to the bathroom and realized something was wrong when she noticed she was not wearing the underwear she had had on last night and that her tampon was pushed all the way inside of her to the extent that she could not reach the string. She testified that she never pushed a tampon in that far before and that she would never have sex with her tampon in or when she was on her period. She went to the CQ desk and eventually spoke to SHOP and then had a safe exam done. During this time, she reached out to friends to see what happened that night. She was upset, crying, and confused when she spoke to these people. And then Staff Sergeant Mendoza also spoke to people. He said that she fell asleep in his bed. And when he talked to the victim herself, he said nothing happened that night. However, later, he spoke with CID, in which he stated that he did have sexual intercourse with the victim in his barracks room. While also admitting some mistake of fact evidence, he also stated that she was extremely intoxicated at the time and she was incapable of consenting. He also admitted that he was in control during the sexual intercourse, but he never admitted that JW or the victim verbally or physically withheld consent. USASIL confirmed the presence of semen on her cervical swabs taken during the safe, which matched the appellant's DNA. Witnesses testified that they saw her drink and socialize with other soldiers, including Staff Sergeant Mendoza, while displaying symptoms of intoxication, including slurred speech and unsteady movements. Others noticed that she was flirting with the appellant and others at the party. They were able to recover some CCTV footage, which showed her walking unsteadily with the appellant to his room and while the appellant grabbed her crotch. Later, the footage captured her and the appellant exiting his room with her arms draped over him, using his shoulders for support. The victim testified she remembered nothing from this encounter.
And that's going to be an important fact for us moving forward, Alex, because this is a very, how do I put it? When we're dealing with whether the charge, substantial incapacitation, or without consent, these are fact-driven analyses, which is why we're going through the facts in this case so heavily.
Yes, I think the facts here are super important on what was charged and what was not charged.
And what the government can prove and ultimately prove that fits within the statutory scheme that we're all dealing with out in the field.
Yes. A military judge sitting at the GCM convicted him of the one specification of sexual assault without consent and sentenced him to a DD and 30 months confinement.
And procedurally, how do we end up where we're at now?
So on appeal before ACCA, appellant argued that the evidence was factually insufficient because the government failed to introduce affirmative evidence of the lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt. ACCA rejected this argument, stating several factors that led to his conviction being factually sufficient, including her high level of intoxication, his statement to CID, eyewitness testimony, and the CCTV footage. ACCA affirmed his conviction. However, in front of CAF, CAF found that the government's approach conflated two different and inconsistent theories of criminal liability and raised significant due process concerns. And because ACCA's decision to uphold his conviction does not explain how or why the evidence of her intoxication factored into their analysis, CAF granted review to determine whether the conviction for sexual assault without consent was legally sufficient.
And Dustin, we're back to a regular theme from the last couple podcasts about statutory construction and breaking down the elements and actually getting in the nitty gritty.
Right. This seems to be a theme from the last few episodes. So I will say we did skip ahead for this one. So if you've been paying attention the last few weeks, we've been kind of knocking out some of CAF's older opinions. We went to this one because this is a big one. And for those practitioners in the field, I really think that this is the case that's going to change your practice the most of probably any opinion that's come out in the last 2-3 years. I know that we in the department have all been kind of waiting for this one as it came out and looking to see what it does with Article 120. But yes, this really comes down to statutory interpretation and looking at what the actual elements of the statute say.
And I think it's worth going over again. Alex, could you just break down the differences between incapable of consenting and without consent? Really just drive home that point for the listeners.
So without consent criminalizes engaging in a sexual act with a person capable of consenting, but who did not in fact consent. However, when charging incapable of consenting, it criminalizes engaging in a sexual act with a person who is incapable of consenting due to impairment by any drug or intoxicant when the accused knows or should have known that the person was incapable of consent. So there is that additional element on the incapable of consenting elements.
And how'd that play into the court's analysis, Dustin?
Yeah, so they take a look back at the greater statutory picture, and I think you really have to zoom out here and understand what's going on here. So what Alex is talking about, these two different charges have different places in the statutory schema. So sexual assault without consent is codified in Article 120B2A. Two elements of that offense: performing a sexual act with the victim when they did not consent. Kind of end of analysis. That's how you're found guilty of a sexual assault without consent. Incapable of consenting is found in Article 120B3A. So again, that's a sexual act when the person is incapable of consenting due to drugs, alcohol, or other intoxicant. And again, like Alex pointed out, an additional element when the accused knew or reasonably should have known of that condition on the part of the victim. So different statutes. The reason we got here and the reason that we're in this position today is because of some of the difficulties that practitioners face when charging 120B3A. This traces back to a 2016 opinion in United States versus Pease. So in Pease, they looked at what that phrase incapable of consenting means. It's since been codified. It's in the definitions of Article 120. So if you look at 120G8, they define what incapable of consenting is. And to break it down in kind of like simple, plain English, to be incapable of consenting due to drugs, intoxicant, or other sort of impairment, you have to be able to, one, be unable to communicate your unwillingness to participate, or two, be physically unable to show your unwillingness to participate. And think about how intoxicated a person has to be when they're either A, incapable of talking about it, or B, incapable of physically resisting. Here, I mean, that this case kind of highlights that difficulty for us perfectly. You have some testimony, you have some evidence that the victim was up walking around, that she may have been making out with someone beforehand, that she walks back to the accused barracks room with him. And in the accused words, like, she's engaging in some sort of sexual activity with him before the alleged sexual assault occurs. I mean, that becomes really difficult when you're charging to decide that, when you're deciding to charge this. Do you charge it as without consent, where you have some evidence the victim did not consent? Or do you charge incapable, knowing that you're going to have to face this difficult standard to meet?
And some of this charging schemes goes back to the definition of actual consent, right?
Yeah, so and it gets even further complicated when you look at how consent is defined. And so the definition of consent is, again, statutory. It's in 120G7A through B. So the 120G7A definition is pretty typical consent type stuff. It's the instruction that we hear again and again and again at trial. G7B is where this gets really complicated because it says in that statute, and I'm paraphrasing again just for plain English, that an asleep, unconscious, or incompetent person cannot consent to a sexual assault, to a sexual act. There's been some kind of conflation of incompetent and incapable in the field. I know when I was practicing a few years ago that there was a strong belief among many practitioners that incompetent and incapable were the same thing. So basically, you could charge 120B2A, sexual assault without consent, and basically get free chicken. Like, you could mean incapable of consenting because of that broad definition in 120G7B.
And it goes back to Alex's earlier point about the additional, you eliminate that additional element of knew or reasonably should have known.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems the majority points out here. And even Judge Sparks's concurrence points out, like, you get a free element when you do that, which just for due process purpose does seem unfair. And we'll talk about, after we go through the analysis here, why there's other due process concerns here, especially with the three of us that have been defense counsel before, and how different your case looks if you're defending without consent versus incapable of consent. But the majority and Judge Sparks have a real good point here. And I mean, Judge Maggs agrees with them that these are different too. So really all five judges agree that these are fundamentally different statutes and should be charged differently.
Well, since you mentioned it, let's hop down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. I know you and I get accused of being nerdy quite a lot, James, on this podcast. I've had several listeners reach back out to us. I'm guilty as charged in that. So we're going to really dig into this, and it's complicated. By attacking this for legal sufficiency, the question is whether or not a reasonable fact finder could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that all of these elements were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's any reasonable fact finder. And this is a really low bar when you think about it. So when this case was first granted, I know you and I talked about that we may not get an answer to this question like we did because of that low threshold. And if you read the first part of the opinion, they could have answered the question just there and stopped. Because Defense Appellate Division's argument was that this statute, 120B2A, requires affirmative proof of non-consent, that you have to show that the victim did not consent affirmatively. They could have answered that question in the negative, which they did, and just ended there. It's kind of the second part that was a little bit more surprising to you and I, and the fact that they got into this analysis is great for the field. So they go in and they break down these two statutes. And Judge Hardy, writing from the majority, is like, we agree that these criminalize different things and it's a due process concern. And it goes back to that pure statutory analysis.
Yeah, because if you look at page 9 of the opinion, they literally put the statute in the opinion. Statutory construction, reading the statute, going to the bench book, going to part four of the manual, is so important, but it's so important. Practitioners in the field, defense, government, judges, start with the text of the statute because that will always control.
Yeah, and there's a really good argument, and I think the majority hangs their hat on this, that this statute would not exist on its own. 120B3A, the incapable consenting statute, would not exist on its own if it was swallowed up by the 120B2A portion of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So why have separate statutes criminalizing these two distinct activities if 120B2A, sexual assault without consent, could just occupy the entire field of it? It just doesn't make sense for it to be there if that were the case. So right off the bat, this is a due process concern to charge one and mean the other, to charge sexual assault without consent and to mean sexual assault by substantial incapacitation. And the reason for that is, think about the way, defense counsel, your case looks differently. So if I'm notified of sexual assault without consent, my mind as a defense counsel is immediately going to consent and mistake a fact as to consent. It's just a fact of life. That's where you win most of these cases as a defense counsel. If I'm presented a charge sheet that has sexual assault by substantial incapacitation, my mind immediately goes to, well, I need an expert on forensic toxicology.
Or in the amount of evidence that you're looking at, it becomes different.
That's right.
Right? Alex, you're nodding over there.
Yes, and I think you're hanging your hat on P's instruction, in that there's not one simple thing that can show someone is too incapable of consenting. So in defense, when you're fighting against an incapable of consenting, you're pointing out all the things that she did that showed that she wasn't incapable. Like here, where you have walking, talking, drinking, getting to a room. And if you take the accused version or Mendoza's version of her actively engaging in oral sex and things of that nature, you would use that to show that a reasonable person wouldn't have known she could not have consented.
Not being able to consent and proving you did not consent are fundamentally two different questions.
Very, very different types of cases. Very different. So the fact that they call this a due process concern, like, it really hits the nail right on the head. Like, this is a due process concern because it changes the nature of the case. And remember, We're a notice pleading jurisdiction, so you don't get a lot of information on the charge sheet a lot of times. So you have to be able to glean from the charge sheet what your case is going to look like, and now I think you can. It's not the end, though. If that were it, there'd be a good argument that you can't charge one or the other and really mean the other one, but the water gets a little bit less clear and a little bit more muddy, and the majority doesn't mean to do this, I don't think, but I just think how complicated the statute is just kind of lends itself to it. So first, they point out that affirmative evidence of non-consent is not required. So you don't need to have actual evidence that the victim said no or manifested non-consent in some way. So because of the definition 120G7C of what consent is, and you can consider all the surrounding facts and circumstances, there can be circumstantial evidence of non-consent. And one of those things you can consider, and this is straight from the majority opinion, is the intoxication of the victim. So the fact that the victim's intoxicated is something you can take into account when determining whether or not they actually did not consent.
But it's that prism that it's being looked at is wildly different.
Very different. The second thing that the majority says that I think makes this a little complicated is Ellis Peru is still good law. So Ellis Peru is a case from about 5 or 6 years ago that talks about charging the alternative for exigencies of proof. So what does that mean? That means you still could charge sexual assault without consent under 120B2A and sexual assault via substantial incapacitation under 120B3A in the alternative. If you have a close case like this, that is still a viable charging option for the government. Buyer beware, because you could be walking into a trap set by the defense where they ask, well, the government doesn't know which one it is, so which one is it? But that's still a viable charging theory.
Alex, what do we ultimately do with this case?
We ultimately kick it back to ACCA for a new legal and factual sufficiency review.
And we usually don't forecast in CAF cases, but there's a kind of a pseudo, not, well, I don't want to call it a trailer because that's the wrong term, but we have another similar issue coming up very soon with CAF as well.
Yeah, Casillas. Yes. If you think this is big, Casillas could fundamentally change the practice in Article 120 if I'm reading the way that CAF granted the issue. So they're taking a closer look at the statutory scheme of this, and they're taking a look at whether or not, if you read 120B2A, 120B3A, and 120G7B in conjunction with each other, if that makes 120 unconstitutionally broad and or vague.
So you went real nerd there. Let's talk this case, though. Is this case a case good for incapable of consenting?
Yeah, no, I think that this becomes a much more utilized charging theory from here going forward. I think that if you mean substantial incapacitation from now on, you charge substantial incapacitation. This whole, I'm going to rely on the G7B definition of consent and the incompetent word in there to save me and let me get free chicken, it's gone. Don't do that anymore. If you mean substantial incapacitation, you charge substantial incapacitation. If you mean without consent, you mean without consent. And I've gotten a few calls since this case has been decided. That doesn't mean you always charge any alternative for both. And in fact, I caution you on doing so because you're probably walking into a trap set by the defense. You have to sit down and analyze what your evidence is. You have to sit down and look at the elements. You have to sit down and look at the definitions. And you have to determine which one of these two different statutes it means. If you have evidence the victim couldn't talk, couldn't walk, couldn't physically resist, you're in substantial incapacitation land. If you have evidence that they did not want to participate in the sexual act and they communicate that in some way, either verbally or through any kind of body language or through anything else, you're in without consent land. Just make a choice that's based on the evidence.
I think one of the things I took away from this, though, was being able to use the incapacitation or the things that the victim may have displayed that night to buttress your non-consent theory. So I think that's something that we've always tried to stay away from in terms of in the field of if we have a non-consent, not getting too deep into the incapacitation because it just opened it up. But I think this is interesting to then buttress it up to prove your non-consent, which is not something I think that was necessarily happening that often in the field.
Yeah, I think for prosecutors, defense counsel, if they're smart, are going to start objecting to any kind of intoxication evidence and without consent cases from now going forward. And they're going to cite to Mendoza and say, they've made this not relevant by charging without consent. That's false. You can look at the opinion itself and say that intoxication is still relevant. You can use it to kind of bootstrap your claim that the victim did not consent. Like the fact that they were intoxicated lended to that. So it's not game over for that type of evidence. It's just you have to be thoughtful about it.
And everyone needs to still go through the relevance analysis and then the 403 analysis. This is not a, you pull one lever, you automatically get to put this type of evidence in. You pull this lever, you get to put this type of evidence in. Every piece of evidence you put in has to relate to your charge that you put on the charge sheet, the statutory elements, the mens rea, the actus reus, and each one of those cases is going to have its own individual analysis. You just can't simply say, well, they charged without consent, therefore intoxication is always relevant or always not relevant. There is going to be a lot of gray area out there, and if you can point to an element, a specific fact of why it's relevant and articulate that to the judge, then you're going to be good. Or in the inverse, if you're doing your case prep and you can't point out to something like that, you need to be prepared for that objection to be sustained, or you need to change your trial theory.
Yeah, I want to point out one more thing that we go before we go before that's in Judge Sparks' concurring opinion. So I think that there's a good nugget in there to kind of make this a little bit easier for practitioners too. And I'm on page 16 of the slip opinion for Judge Sparks' concurrence, and I'm going to quote this specifically. So evidence establishing the victim's incapacity necessarily disproves an allegation of sexual assault without consent. So thus, a closer look reveals that these two theories of criminality are legally contradictory rather than overlapping. So I think what he's saying there and what he means is that if you have evidence of one, it necessarily disproves the other. And so if you have evidence of affirmative non-consent, if you have evidence of the victim saying no, that would disprove of incapable of consenting theory. So if you have her saying no or have him saying no, they're necessarily capable of consenting because they're capable of communicating their unwillingness to participate. If you have a victim that's legally incapable of consenting, they're no longer in B2A because you have to be capable of consenting and then not consent under a theory of sexual assault without consent. I think if you think about it in that way, this becomes a little bit easier to understand that they are distinct and separate.
And I'll continue to beat a familiar drum that I've beaten since I've been here at the schoolhouse. This is complicated stuff, and nobody has a corner market on it. So this is where defense, government judges, this is where paralegals, peers, anybody up and down the chain, whether you have 5 years experience, 20 years experience, no experience, everybody can read and everybody can digest this and articulate something that will be beneficial. So just keep an open mind, realize that it's hard, and really do your best just to focus on the elements, actus reus, mens reus, and the things that you actually have to prove in court. So with that, any final words from the two of you?
Keep a lookout for Casillas. I'm interested in that one next.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here. We'd like to thank everybody for continuing to support this this podcast, and feel free to reach out to us with any suggestions or helpful tidbits, but for the rest of you out there in the field, best of luck and keep doing the great work that you're doing, and make sure that you subscribe to ADC's The Calf Chats. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.